Thank you very much. I would like to thank the organizers for inviting me. So I'm going to discuss a joint work with Roberto Ferretti. As an introduction, I would like to start with considering with a simple case first. I would like to start with Ross theorem, which probably you all well know. So I denote the height of the relational number xi to be the maximum of the absolute values of the denominator and numerator. Xi is p over q, with p and p of q co-product integers, then the height of xi is the maximum of the absolute values of p and q. Then Ross theorem states that if alpha is a real algebraic number of and delta is a positive real, then there's inequality, 1, alpha minus xi is smaller than the height of xi to the power minus 2 minus delta. That only finding many solutions in rational number xi. Already shortly after Roth published his proof in 1955, Davenport and Roth published the quantitative version of this theorem, that is an explicit upper bound to the number of solutions, and their result on the number of solutions was later improved by Mignot and Domieri and Van der Poort and Schmidt and myself. The next quantitative version I would like to state on Ross theorem is a slight improvement of my result from 1996. In fact, it's not really new, it's just a routine computation using all the existing techniques. So, so let alpha be an algebraic number of degree b, and delta some real between 0 and 1. Now, in the quantitative version, the result I make a distinction between large solutions and small solutions. Now, a solution is called large if its height is greater than the maximum of 4 to the power 1 of delta and the height of alpha. And the height of alpha is just around the naive height, so the maximum of the absolute values of the coefficients of its minimal polynomial. And the solution is small if the height of xi is smaller than its quantity. Then the quantitative Ross theorem states that the number of large solutions is at most of this quantity, 2 to the 25 delta to the minus 3 log 4d, with d is the degree, logarithm of delta inverse logarithm of 4d, and the number of small solutions is at most 10 times delta to the power minus 1, and then the logarithm of delta inverse times logarithm of 4 times the height of alpha. So the upper bound to the number of large solutions depends only on delta and on the degree d, and the upper bound to the number of small solutions only on delta and the height of alpha. Yes, one over delta. So if delta gets smaller, then the separation between large and small also is bound between the large and small, so it also gets larger.
When delta goes to zero,
now, yes, now the closer delta to zero, the more solution one should expect, isn't it?
No,
both the bounds between large and small increase, and the number of large solutions increase, so you get a much larger bound. If delta tends to zero, then this should tend to. 4 to the. Now, this gets to infinity, this gets to infinity, yeah, assuming that something. Okay, there's not computation gives, you may modify this a little bit to get rid of this and make some modifications here, but. Okay, so the result which one gets is just a combination of what they call an interval result and a gap principle. And the interval result can be stated as follows. There are reals Q1 smaller than Q2 smaller than, say, to the integral part of A over 2. So that if every solution psi of this inequality 1, we have either that the height of psi is smaller than this quantity, maximum 4 to the power 1 over delta and height of alpha, or the height of psi lies in one of these intervals, Q1, Q1 to the power 1 plus delta over 2, united with and so on, to integral part of A over 2, Q integral part of A over 2 to the power 1 plus delta over 2. Now the proof is just by usual way one proves Roth's theorem, and the use of Roth machinery. Suppose this interval result is false, then one can take, say, m solutions, psi 1 to psi m. One can construct an auxiliary polynomial in m variables, which vanishes with high order at the point with variables psi 1 to psi m. But then one applies a non-vanishing result for polynomials, Roth's lemma, which states that such a polynomial cannot exist, and that way one obtains a contradiction. Of course, it's important to remark that these numbers qi, Q1 to QA over 2, cannot be determined effectively. The proof only gives the existence of such numbers, but does not give any information about the size of these numbers. Now one has to combine this interval result with the gap principle. Now this gap principle states that that is inequality 1 has at most 2 solutions psi, with q smaller than the height of psi smaller than q to the power 1 plus delta over 2. Now, probably the proof is well known. Let me just recall the proof of this elementary fact. Suppose that there are 3 solutions with this property, with the height of psi between q and q to the power 1 plus delta over 2. Now, if there are 3 solutions, then and there must be at least 2 at the same side of alpha, so either 2 larger than alpha or 2 smaller than alpha. Now then, you may look at the height of psi 1 times the height of psi 2 to the power minus 1. This is larger than q to the power minus 2 times 1 plus delta over 2. Of course, the both of height smaller than q to the 1 plus delta over 2. And the product of these heights to the power minus 1 is smaller equal to the difference of the psi 1 and psi 2. And this difference is bounded above by the maximum of alpha minus psi 1 and absolute value of alpha minus psi 2, because these solutions were supposed to be both at the same side of alpha. Well, this maximum is bounded above by the height of psi 1 to the power minus 2 minus delta, and the height of psi 2 to the minus 2 minus delta, and this maximum is bounded above by q to the power minus 2 minus delta, because the height was greater or equal than q. Of course, but this gives a contradiction, so this proves the gap principle. Now it's completely clear that if you combine this gap principle with this interval result, you get an upper bound for the number of solutions. Say, for instance, let us consider the large solutions, so solutions with height at least with height large in this quantity, the maximum of 4 to the power 1 over delta and height of alpha, and each of these intervals gives rise to 2 solutions, so we have A over 2 intervals times 2 gives A large upper bound for A for the number of large solutions. Okay, this is just an introduction about Roth's theorem. Now I would like to continue with the subspace theorem. Of course, there is a much more general version of the subspace theorem. Just for simplicity, I would like to only consider this special case. So let Q bar denote the field of algebraic numbers in the complex field. And let L1x up to Lnx be n linearly independent linear forms with algebraic coefficients. Suppose that the linear forms are linearly independent. Now, for the norm of a vector x and z to the n, I just take the maximum norm. Then, as is well known, the subspace theorem, proved by Wolfgang Schmidt in 1972, states that if delta is positive, then the set of solutions of this inequality, product of L1 and set of Lnx in absolute value, is smaller than the norm of x to the power minus delta in x and z to the n. It's contained in the union of finitely many proper linear subspaces of Q to the n. Now, in fact, in my lecture, I don't want to consider this product in the subspace theorem. But instead of this, I would like to consider systems of inequalities of this shape. In fact, now it's just an easy combinatorial argument to show that such a single inequality involving a product of linear forms can be reduced to a finitely many systems of inequalities of this shape. Like in each inequality of only one linear form, so system of the shape absolute value of L1 x smaller than a constant times norm of x to the power minus C1 up to absolute value of Ln x smaller than a constant times norm of x to the power minus Cn in x and z to the n, where this constant C is positive and the sum of the exponents C1 plus C2 up to Cn also must be positive. Now, I believe the proof that of this reduction to reduce the single inequality to this such a system is basically some simple combinatorics. Suppose we write absolute value of LIX as power of norm of x to the power of CI of x. And its vector of exponents, C1x up to CnX, just the vector r to the n. This vector just belongs to a bounded set. Now we can approximate every point in this bounded set by a point from, say, a finite grid. So we can approximate every point of exponent C1 and up to Cnx by a point, say, C1 up to Cn from a finite grid, and each such point from a finite grid gives rise to one system of inequalities 3. Now, in my lecture, I only want to give quantitative results for such systems of inequalities and not for the product. So I will forget about the product now, just continue with the system of inequalities. Okay, now I'd like to come to stating some quantitative versions. And in these quantitative versions, I need some list of technical assumptions. So I will just consider the system of inequalities 3, absolute value of L1 x smaller than constant times the norm of x to the power minus C1, and so on until nx smaller than constant times norm of x to the power minus cn in x and z to the n. Well, L1 to Ln are just linearly independent linear forms with algebraic coefficients. We assume that the height of all the coefficients are bounded above by h, and the degrees of all the coefficients are bounded above by d. This constant c is supposed to be sufficiently small, so it's smaller or equal than the determinant of L1 of Ln, the coefficient determinant of the linear forms to the power 1 over n. The sum of the exponents C1 plus up to Cn is at least delta, a delta between 0 and 1. And further, it's a small technical assumption, and assuming the minimum of the C1 of Cn is equal to minus 1. Now, okay, that's a reasonable condition. Of course, each terms, L1x of Lnx, have absolute value at most constant times the norm of x. So it's reasonable to assume that these minimum of the CIs should be minus 1. Okay, now I'd like to first recall a quantitative version of the subspace theorem, which was proved by Schlegelein and myself a couple of years ago. So, so always in my lecture, I will assume all these conditions listed in 4. The heights are the coefficients of the linear forms bounded above by h, the degrees bounded above by d, c by the determinant, to the power 1 over n, the sum of the exponents is at least delta, and the minimum of the c exponents c1 over cn is equal to minus 1. Again, I consider a system of inequalities. And in Schlegelein, I proved in 2002 that the set of solutions of the system 3 say, we had, say, sufficiently large solution with norm bounds above by the maximum of n to the power 2n over delta and h is contained in a union of at most 4 to the n plus 9 squared, delta to the power minus n minus 4, log 4d, log 4d, proper linear subspaces of q to the n. Let me recall some history on the quantitative subspace theorem. What? What I may need these technical conditions, technical assumptions later. Some history. Now, the first quantitative version of the subspace theorem was proved by Wolfgang Schmidt in 1989. He had a much larger upper bound for the number of subspaces, which is something like W exponential in both N and delta and D. Now, his result was later improved and generalized by Schlieterwey and myself, in various cases. Now, the last result, which was proved together with Schlieterwey, was a consequence of a much more general result, which holds for the subspace theorem over number fields, a much more general version, which also involves several other absolute values. So this is just a special case of a more general result. And the method of proof of this result was a quantification of Schmidt's proof from 1972. And in his original proof of the subspace theorem, Schmidt used the geometry of numbers and he constructed an algebraic polynomial and application of Gauss' lemma. Basically, the method of proof used for Schlieterwey myself was just the structure of the proof was basically similar to the proof of Schmidt from 1972. Of course, with several technical improvements, like for instance, a much sharper version of Rolle's lemma. In 1994, Falten and Wüstholz came with a very different proof of the subspace theorem. In fact, they avoided completely the geometry of numbers used by Schmidt. Instead, they used Falten's product theorem. Further, in the proof, they developed stability theory for vector spaces, which is an important ingredient. Further, in the course of the proof, they had to deal with Diophantine approximation on nonlinear projective varieties. In fact, if you go through the proof of Falten and Wüstholz, one can also deduce an explicit upper bound for the number of subspaces. But this upper bound coming from the method of Falten and Wüstholz is much larger than the one you obtained together with Schlieterwey. In fact, and the reason that the bounds obtained from the method of Falten and Wüstholz was so large is that in the proof one has to, in fact, deal with Diophantine approximation of nonlinear varieties, nonlinear projective varieties. In fact, the proof of Falten and Wüstholz is a sort of inductive argument. Each inductive step gets a projective variety which has a smaller dimension but a much larger degree. The degrees of these projective varieties get larger and larger, and that more or less blows up the upper bound for the number of subspaces. But as it turns out, it's possible to make a further improvement on the upper bound for the number of subspaces by combining ideas from Schmidt's proof with ideas from method proof of Falten and Wüstholz. And that leads then to a further improvement. So we consider again the system of inequalities. We make again all these technical assumptions listed here. We consider the system of inequalities 3, L1x smaller than constant times norm of x to the power minus c1 up to Lnx, and absolute value smaller than constant x to the power minus cn in x and z to the n. Now, completely similarly as in the quantitative version of Roth's proof, we make a distinction between the large solutions and the small solutions. So solution is called large if the norm of the solution x is more greater even in maximum of n to the power 2n over delta and h. So h is an upper bound for the height of the coefficient of the linear forms. Now then, the theorem obtained with Rebecca Ferretti states that the set of solution, set of large solutions of this system tree, so with norm of x larger than this bound, is contained in the union of 2 to the 2n, 10n to the 20, delta to the power minus 3, log delta inverse, log 4d, log delta inverse, log 4d, proper linear subspace of q to the n, and the small solutions, where norm of x smaller than this bound, are contained in the union of the most 10 to the power 3n, delta inverse, log 4h, proper linear subspaces of q to the n. So now, if I compare this with the previous result obtained, which I obtained together with Schlitterly, bound for Schlitterly, we had some bound of the shape constant to the n squared, and with something like delta to the power minus n minus 4, so we can combined with your Schlitterly bound, so we have an improvement in terms of the number of variables, also an improvement in terms of delta. And in fact, in terms of delta, the bounds we get are almost the same as the quantitative version of Rolle's theorem. In fact, in terms of delta, you have basically precisely the same dependence as in the quantitative version of Rolle's theorem, only except for this term log delta inverse. Okay, now, later I will say more about the proof, what's going into the proof, but in fact, as I mentioned already, the proof uses ideas from both the methods of Schmidt and of Faltings and Russell's. In fact, we still follow Schmidt's method, we will follow Schmidt's method of proof, but in his proof, Schmidt had a particular construction of an auxiliary polynomial, and we replaced that by another construction of an auxiliary polynomial due to Faltings and Russell's, and a different construction leads to the better bound for the number of subspaces. Okay, now, next thing which I would like to discuss is on the refinement of the subspace theorem. So, of course, we consider again the system of inequalities, L1 makes an absolute value smaller than constant times norm of x to the power minus c1 up to LnX smaller than constant times norm of x to the power minus cn, where the sum of the exponents is positive. And then it follows from Burke-Voita from 1989, Schmidt from 1993, and Faltings and Russell's from 1994, that there is a single subspace, properly in a subspace D0 of Q to the n, such that all solutions of this system tree lie outside this subspace. Now further, this subspace D0 can be determined effectively. And further, the system of inequality tree has only finitely many solutions outside T0. Further, the subspace T0 can be chosen from a finite set which depends only on the linear forms L1 to Ln. The subspace is this collection is independent of C1 up to Cn and independent of this constant C. Now, so from a first glance, it seems to be much stronger than the Schmidt subspace theorem. Schmidt subspace theorem says that the solutions lie only finding many proper linear subspaces, and the refinement states that that are only finding many solutions outside a single subspace T0, but in fact this refinement can be deduced from this basic Schmidt subspace theorem, so it's equivalent to Schmidt subspace theorem. Okay, now let me say a few words on this exceptional subspace T0. This subspace T0 can just be defined in some combinatorial manner. For simplicity, I will restrict myself to the case that all the linear forms L1 up to Ln have real algebraic coefficients. In that case, in the case that some of the coefficients are complex, the description of T0 gets slightly more complicated. that, let's assume that the coefficients are all real, then the space T0 can be described as follows. So for any, if T is any linear subspace of Q to the N, I define a quantity which I call nu T. It can be defined as follows. So let N be the dimension of T, and I consider all tuples I want to IM, all subsets I want to IM of set of indices 1 to N, such that the range of the restrictions of the linear forms Li1 to Lm2T is equal to M. And then I take the, and I consider all the sums of the exponents Ci1 plus up to Cim for M, and take the maximum of all these sums over all tuples I want to M, and the consideration for which the rank is equal to M. And then, as it turns out, there is a unique subspace T0 of Q to the N. So I said the new value of T0 is the minimum of all new values all the linear subspaces of Q to the N. And further, yeah, there may be more spaces for which is minimal new value, and more all spaces with minimal new value, I take one with a larger dimension. As it turns out, this space is uniquely determined, it is our exceptional subspace, T0. Okay, now in fact, now more or less we have a situation which is more or less analogous to the quantitative version of Gott's theorem. So we have a similar sort of interval result. So we can, again, we consider a system of inequalities 3. Here we have this the list of technical assumptions which I assume throughout. So let me just assume this list of technical assumptions listed here. So we consider again a system of inequalities. Then the interval results states the result states that if so let A be its quantity 2 to the 2n, 10n to the 20, delta to the minus 3, log that delta inverse, log 4d, then log inverse delta inverse log 4d, then just the same, the fact that the upper bounds of the number of subspaces contain the large solutions in the first theorem of Roberto Ferretti and myself, then the positive reals q1 smaller than q2 up to smaller than q integral parts a minus 1, so it's every solution x and z to the end of the system 3 outside the exceptional subspace t0. We have that either the norm of x is smaller than this quantity maximum of n to the 2n over delta and h, so that's the boundary between large and small solutions, or the norm of x is lying in one of these intervals, q1 to the power 1 plus delta over n, and so on until q integral part of a minus 1, q integral part of a minus 1 to the power 1 plus delta over n. Integral result, and completely similarly as in Fuller-Rotz theorem, we have to combine it with the gap principle. So of course we assume all these technical assumptions again. We consider the system of inequalities, L1 x smaller than constant like x to the minus C1 and 1 and so on. Now and then the gap principle states if the Q is greater or equal than 2, then a set of solutions of the system 3 with norm of x between Q and Q to the 1 plus delta over n. Now, it's contained in only one proper linear subspace Q to the n if Q is greater or equal than n to the power 2n over delta. And now, if Q is smaller than n to the 2n over delta, then these solutions are contained in the union of at most 300 to the n proper linear subspace of Q to the n. Now, this first part of the gap principle is very simple to prove. The second part is more involved. It could very well be possible that with a simpler argument it could get some better bounds. I really don't know whether this really has to be exponential in n. Perhaps it can be better, I don't know. But well, at least for small q, we'll get a larger upper bound for the number of subspaces. Okay, now we just combine this with the interval result. So let's consider the large solutions, so the solutions with norm x larger than this quantity. Well, then each of these intervals gives rise to only one subspace, so all these intervals together give rise to, say, A minus one subspace, where A is this subspace, where A is this quantity, and together with T0, we just get A subspace, and we get an upper bound A for the number of subspaces containing the large solutions. Now it's of course also clear that if you consider the small solutions with norm of X smaller than this quantity, then with the second part of the gap principle, we can estimate the number of subspaces containing the small solution. So, of course, by combining this interval result in the gap principle, we get an upper bound for the number of subspaces containing the solutions of system 3. And there is an open problem. In fact, the main problem with the gap principle, well, let me just keep this. Open problem. Yeah, the gap principle is only bound for the number of subspaces for the norm when the norm of X is between Q and Q to the power 1 plus delta over N. Now, this is a big open problem. We know that there are only finitely many solutions of the system outside the space T0. So this is a heavy open problem. In fact, very difficult to give an upper bound to the number of solutions outside T0. So it's really, what we would like to have is a gap principle which does not count the number of subspaces, but count the number of solutions. But it seems to be very hard to get such a gap principle. In fact, there was an observation by Wolfgang Schmidt from 1990 that he considered a very particular case of this system of inequalities, and he showed that suppose we would have an explicit upper bound to the number of solutions of such this system, then from that upper bound we would be able to derive some very strong effective Diophantine inequalities. Now let me just give another example of this phenomenon. Quite elementary to prove. So let alpha be a real algebraic number of degree at least 4. Delta be a positive real. Let us consider a system of inequalities, x1 plus alpha x2 plus alpha squared x3. F to tell is smaller than the norm of x to the power minus 2 minus delta. And second inequality is f to tell of x2 smaller or equal to the norm of x and x3 smaller or equal to the norm of x. Of course, the last two inequalities are totally trivial, but of course, they all together are just a special case of, form a special case of this system of this type. Now, it's already a very classical result of Schmidt, already much older than the subspace theorem. In fact, systems of this shape have only finitely many solutions. In fact, one can also show that the exceptional subspace in this particular case is equal to zero. So also from the refinement of the subspace theorem, it follows that this system is only finitely many solutions. And then we can prove the following elementary fact. Suppose we have an explicit upper bound for the number of solutions of the system 5. Now we can even take ourselves to primitive solutions with a greater common divisor of x1, x2, x3 is equal to 1. So suppose you have an upper bound to the number of primitive solutions. If every rational number psi with the absolute value of alpha minus psi bounded below by 2 times alpha 1 plus alpha absolute value to the power of n to the power minus 2 minus delta times the height of psi to the power minus 3 minus delta. So this is really a very strong, effective lower bound for difference between alpha and a rational number. So eventually we would like an effective version of Rolle's theorem, which would give an effective lower bound in height of psi to the power minus 2 delta. But at least it shows that if you have an explicit upper bound to the number of solutions of such systems, then from that we would be able to get an effective lower bound for alpha minus psi, which is really much better than anything which has been achieved so far. So it more or less suggests that getting an explicit upper bound to the number of solutions of systems of the shape 5 must be at least as difficult as obtaining such a very strong effective irrationality measure for alpha. So at least it suggests it must be a very hard problem to estimate the number of solutions of such systems. Okay, now I'd like to say a few words on the proof of this quantitative improvement of the result with Cerretti. So we consider again a system of inequalities. Now one x natural value is smaller than constant times norm of x to the power minus e1. I tell n x natural value is smaller than constant times norm of x to the power minus e1. And then one of the ingenious ideas of Schmidt in his proof of the success theorem was to construct for every solution x of the system of inequalities of some parallel pivot. The dimension of this parallel pivot was some dimension r smaller or equal than 2 to the power n. The parallel pivot of the shape, just some system of inequalities, miz smaller than norm of x to the power minus the I of x I is 1 to r. This parallel pivot is such that if I intersect it with z to the r, then the intersection generates a linear subspace t of x of q to the power of r of dimension r minus 1. So basically, one can translate it in terms of successive minima. So if I have this parallel pivot as r successive minima, lambda 1, lambda 2, up to lambda r, then this parallel pivot has the property that the first r minus 1 successive minima are rather small and most equal to 1, and the r successive minima is very large. So it is r minus 1 small successive minima and 1 very large successive minimum. These linear forms m1 and mr are linearly dependent, independent linear forms in r variables with real algebraic coefficients. The linear forms are independent of x, but there is a problem in the proof that the exponents, the 1 x of the rx, may be dependent on x. So it's really causing some practical problems that the exponents are dependent on x. Now, okay, so there was some problem to deal with, the problem with these exponents. Now, in fact, I wrote the Flieckerlein myself. Was more or less, in the approach of Flieckerlein himself, it's really necessary to be able to deal with the case that all the exponents are more or less constant, that the I of x are independent of x. So the idea of Flieckerlein myself, was also used in earlier versions of the quantitative surface theorem, was to divide the solutions of this system of inequalities tree into classes in such a way that you have two solutions, x and x prime, in the same class, and the corresponding exponents are about equal. So for solutions x and x prime in the same class, if the di of x is approximately equal to the di of x prime, I is equal to r. So then next step, we just restrict ourselves to solutions from a fixed class. So for solutions in a fixed class, all the exponents, all the di x's are in fact just a constant, independent of x. Then so we pick solutions from the same class, and then we construct an auxiliary polynomial via using Schmidt's approach of such a construction. So just auxiliary polynomial P Z1 of Zm in M blocks of R variables. So Z1 of Zm, Z1 of Zm are the blocks of R variables. And this polynomial vanishes with high multiplicity at all points in the Cartesian product of the spaces Tx1 up to Txm. So we take the point Z1 and Txm1, Z2 and Tx2 up to Zm and Txm. Then this polynomial vanishes with high order at all the points Z1 up to Zm. Now, this is a very strong condition on this polynomial, and using Rod's lemma shows that such polynomial cannot exist. So we get the contradiction using Rod's lemma. Now, as it turns out, this upper bound number of classes, the number of classes can be estimated from above by gamma to the n squared delta to the minus n. So gamma is just an absolute constant, and delta is the sum of the exponents in this system. Now, in fact, this term, upper bound to the number of classes, dominates the resulting upper bound to the number of subspaces in the bound to Flieckerlein myself. So all the other estimates are much smaller. So this upper bound to the number of classes is really the dominating term. The improvements was that, in fact, that instead of using Schmidt's construction of an auxiliary polynomial, we use the construction of Faltings and Wüstholz. Now, the advantage of this construction of Faltings and Wüstholz is that it was not necessary anymore to pick solutions from the same class. You could just take solutions from different classes. So even if we have solutions from different classes, we can still construct a polynomial pz dot pz m in such a way that just finishes with high multiplicity at all the points in the Cartesian product tx1 to txm, and again we can derive a contradiction using Rod's lemma. So we do not have to divide the solutions into these classes anymore. In that way, okay, we don't have the upper bound to the number of classes in the upper bound. We can save this factor gamma to the n squared delta 2 minus n. That leads eventually to the better upper bound to the number of subspaces. Okay, let me say a few words on how these different polynomials are constructed. So we have to construct an auxiliary polynomial, pz1 of zm, small height in m blocks, z1 of zm in r variables. This polynomial is homogeneous of degree dh in the block zh for h is 1 to m. In fact, the construction is always such that the degree is d1 in the first block, d2 in the second block, and so on, dm in the last block. These degrees form a very rapidly decreasing sequence. The quotients of d1 over d2, d2 over d3, etc. are very large, so just a basic assumption which one has to make. And we can express this polynomial as a product of powers of terms m, j, z, h. These m's linear forms, m1 to mr, were these linear forms which appeared in parallel pipette, which we derived in the course of the proof. So we can express this polynomial as a linear combination of such terms, and the summations over tuples both phase I h, j, such that the sum from j is 1 to r, I h, j is equal to dh for h is 1 to m. So the idea in the construction is to construct this polynomial in such a way that sufficiently many of these coefficients ci vanish. Okay, now Schmidt construction was to construct p with small height such that this coefficient ci is equal to 0 if the maximum for j between 1 and n of the sum from h is 1 to m a I h j over dh minus m over r as absolute value at least epsilon. Epsilon is we had a system of inequalities, L1 x smaller than the norm of x to the power minus c1, etc. The sum of the exponents in the system of inequalities was delta. Epsilon is then some sort of function of delta. Now, in fact, if we just take the average of over all these sums, of all these tuples with these properties, sum of j is equal to r, I a j equal to d of h, and the average of all these sums is just equal to m over r, I'm just forced from the law of large numbers from probability theory that in fact most tuples, both phase I, this sum is very close to this average. So by the law of large numbers, there are only few tuples both phase I for which the maximum is greater than epsilon. Okay, so in fact, the number of tuples I with this property is much smaller than the total number of coefficients of P. Now, we may interpret all these coefficients, the condition ci equals 0 as a linear equation in the coefficients of this polynomial P. So basically, you get a system of linear equations. The number of equations is much smaller than the number of variables. Okay, and then we can construct polynomial P with small height using Zeigler's lemma. Just a very standard construction. Now, the idea of faulting the Wüstholdt was basically much more general. With that construction, we can take any real numbers alpha hj of absolute value at most equal to 1 for h is 1 to m, j is 1 to r. Then we construct polynomial p with small height such that ci is equal to 0 if the sum h is 1 to m, j is 1 to r, alpha hj, I hj over dh minus 1 over r is absolute value at least epsilon. In fact, again, with the law of large numbers, if you take the sum of h is 1 to m, j is 1 for most of the tuples I, the sum is very small, so only very few tuples I for which the sum is at least epsilon. The number of tuples I which is property is much smaller than the coefficient of p again. So then again, using Zeigler's lemma, we can construct a polynomial. Now, the importance is we have much more flexibility because of we have a free choice of these real numbers alpha hj. The idea was that we can take solutions from different classes, x1 to xm, we can more or less adapt these alpha hj to the classes from which we are taking our solution, so we have much more flexibility that allows us that makes it possible that the polynomial also works if it takes solutions from different classes. Now this more or less concludes my lecture. Okay, and the only thing which I would like to say, I don't have the slide here at hand, I just mentioned only a very special case of the results I obtained together with Robert Ferretti. We have much more general results which deal with the version of the surface theorem just with any finite number of finite set of absolute values, and also with unknowns from the algebraic number field. And also in this more general case, we're able to obtain improved versions of the improved upper bounds of the number of subspaces. So I would like to finish my lecture here.